Revolutionary reform, which we wouldn't necessarily endorse today. But one of the translators is somebody called PJT, and he's appears in the directory using his Irish name. I think he must have been like Conor Lehane, a former member of the Irish Socialist Republican Party. I don't know what happened to him. I think he went off to South America as a translator. Anybody want to ask any questions or say anything? You don't want to say, Darren, what happened to T.A. Jackson and Conor Lehane?
I mean, I can if you want, but
Well, nobody's.
I did talk a lot, you know.
Yeah, but nobody else wants to ask a question or say anything, so.
Okay, with regards to Con Lehane, first general secretary of the party, as Adam mentioned, he was originally from Cork. He was a member of Connolly's, the was it the Irish Republican Socialist Party, Irish Socialist Party, I can't remember. In the early 1890s, early 1900s, obviously the dominance of the Catholic Church in Ireland at that time meant that to speak out as he did, basically, I think he was asked politely to leave, or not so politely. So he rocks up in London and is part of the Impossibilist revolt. He's kind of front and center in that picture that I mentioned from the 1905 annual conference. Quite a tall guy, quite striking looking. I think he's clean shaven, as Adam mentioned. There was the first this, the organizational dispute was in the party. It was over the issue of trade unions, socialist industrial unionism, which led to AGB Allen and others leaving. Islington branch, to which Lehane was quite a leading member at the time, they kind of objected to certain sort of procedural matters within the party, like party democracy. They basically, I believe Bexley branch had issued, had put forward a resolution committing the party to socialist industrial unionism. It got voted down. Islington branch was like, this shouldn't have even been on the table. It's a very strange, I don't pretend to fully understand what was going on here, but they objected to even being sort of allowed to be put forward to a conference or a ADM, and they wanted this resolution to be expunged from the party records, which to me is just very strange. And the rest of the party basically turned around and said, no, this happened. What you say, this is like weird, it's almost like Orwellian before Orwell. And the majority of Islington branch took umbrage and thought, oh, the SPGB is lost. It has become reform. I don't even know if it's reformist or whatever, but they left as a branch. I think it was 21, 22 members left. They issued two pamphlets denouncing the party, which I believe are on the archive.org. I believe Daryl actually scanned them in. I've never read them because it's very difficult to read them. And they kind of disappeared. Lehane himself, he was in America during the First World War, and he was actually quite a prominent speaker within the Socialist Party of America. I won't say he was too high, but he was kind of like listed as a public speaker to the point where this party and the Socialist Standard, I believe 1915, 1916, even had to like write an article saying, oh, one of our ex-members has turned up overseas, and this is, we have to restate who he was and why he left, because Lehane was quite a, he obviously was kind of liked him, he had a very high opinion of himself. So I think he was kind of, when he was speaking in America, he was touting himself, the former general secretary of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, etc. And I believe he died during Spanish flu, I think 1918, 1919. Yeah. With regards to T.A. Jackson, founder member of the party, best known today for being a leading member of the British Communist Party from the 20s up to the 50s. He wrote his autobiography called Solo Trumpet in the early 50s, where he doesn't mention the party by name, even though he mentions party members, because I guess the party couldn't be mentioned in the CPGB circles at that time. He was a very good writer, Orwell. He wrote a book on Dickens in the 30s, and there's a famous essay by Orwell on Dickens, on the politicization of Dickens. I can't remember the title of the essay, but one of the writers he tackles at length is T.A. Jackson. His daughter, Stella Jackson, actually joined the party in the 1930s when T.A. Jackson was on the Central Committee of the CPGB, which probably made family gatherings quite interesting at the time. She was a very active writer and speaker in the party in the first half of the 1930s. I believe someone's writing a biography of her as we speak, which will be interesting to see what she says about the party, because when I contacted her about it, she didn't actually know about her party membership. Yeah, that's, I'm sure there's other stuff, but yeah. Cheers.
Great, thanks. I see Howard, you got your hand up.
Hi, yes. Thanks very much indeed, both Adam and Darren, for an illuminating outline of the party in the first decade of the 20th century. I've been looking at the articles in the June 1905 Standard, and the one that really stands out in terms of the kind of thing happening today is the one Adam mentioned, entitled Alien Humbug, you know, about the coming 1905 Aliens Act to keep the, basically designed to keep the East European Jews out. My God, it's so reminiscent of the stuff that's going on today. And it's so reminiscent, and the party's take on it and the way it expresses it is so reminiscent of what we are saying. I happen to have seen the upcoming snippets on the party's website, which will be published this coming Wednesday, and how similar it is, both in tone, almost in language. Okay, there are a few references that wouldn't have applied in 1905, but good heavens, you know, you could say that, you know, in capitalism, times don't change. And certainly, thank goodness, you know, the party's take on these things remains constant and consistent. So, yeah, I mean, absolutely fascinating to look back in that way. And, you know, good idea to do it as well. You know, it'll probably make some of us want to look back at the early standards. You know, it's been much more difficult in the past because we've had to look at the paper copies. Now they're so readily available and sort of, you know, so easy to read. Strongly recommend people to have a look at some of them.
Thanks. There was a later article, I think, in about 1910 called Who Are the Aliens? And you can guess who they are, really. They're the capitalist class.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Oh, and incidentally, if I can just sort of come in again, I've also clicked on the From Our Branches link, and there's news from various branches, from Watford, Islington, Romford and West Ham. And West Ham say they quickly hope to establish another branch in East Ham. Don't know whether that ever happened. But heavens, you know, the activity, the enthusiasm is something to behold. And that's unfortunately rather different from now in many ways. But okay, this was the very beginning.
Paddy, is that yeah? Paddy, I think. Yeah. Well, I think some of the questions were the ones that we still get. Who will do the dirty work? What about the lazy man and things? There is a a short story in the June issue. I didn't read it all the way through, but I imagine it's a questions and answer thing about the basics of socialism. But you're right. There was at that time general agreement as to what socialism meant. I think municipalization and nationalization might have been seen as steps towards socialism, but there was agreement on what socialism was. I think it was, I feel like, what are we going to do in the meantime? What about palliatives and that sort of thing? Don't know if you want to add anything to that, Darren?
I'll try and be brief. There'd been a pamphlet issued in the 1890s called, I think, the Manifesto of English Socialists, which was signed by, the luminaries of the Fabians, like Bernard Shaw, the SDF, others, where they did sort of state, as Adam said, what socialism is, and it was pretty much what we would agree with now. It was very much a final goal, but there was a common agreement about what it was. Fast forward 10 years. In a funny way, I don't want to overplay the idea that all the early party members were really young men in a hurry. Because I think some of them are quite seasoned. They're definitely seasoned in politics and the SDF, going back sort of 10 years, 15 years for some. I honestly think, in a way, they kind of saw what was coming and they were trying to head it off. It's all well saying, like 1900, there was two Labour Representation Committee members elected, Pardee and Mayor for Tydvil, and a trade union leader, Richard Bell, who's basically a Liberal in Preston. But from 1900 up to the election, they knew the Tories were going to get kicked out. They knew Labour was, the Labour movement in a political sense was growing because of the Taft Fail judgment. The trade unions couldn't sort of step aside from political activity. So they knew this was coming, and they obviously were looking at places like France and Germany, etc. And I generally think there was if we don't stop this now, then basically this reformism is going to envelop us all. So there was a genuine attempt, I think, to expose the political opportunism of trade union leaders and people in the SDF and the ILP. As Adam mentioned, this idea that socialism coming in the night, or the idea that Fabian socialism is, the society organized by the civil service. And they kind of almost anticipated what eventually panned out, in the succeeding years, that the Labour Party eventually just took over the Liberal Party, that post First World War, when the Liberal Party was split in the middle between, Asquith and Lloyd George, etc. People don't realise how many leading Liberal figures from the Edwardian and First World War period just ended up joining the Labour Party en masse in the 1920s. And you see them in the first minority administration of Macdonald and in second administration 1931. This was basically just like a Liberal, you could argue, pre-1914 majority Liberals, minority Labour, left of centre, capitalist politics. Then fast forward 10, 12 years, because of what happened to the Liberal Party, it basically became the Labour Liberal Party. I think they saw that was coming, and I generally think that's what they were trying to head off. And unfortunately, they didn't, and I think what made it difficult was it wasn't just them that saw it. I think the SDF became so opportunistic in this period and probably contributed to the split, is because they saw the Labour movement was getting politically organised. They saw that people were going to get elected to Parliament and they wanted a piece of it. So people like Hyndman and Will Thorne, who was elected in 1906, was a long-standing SDF, but as a Labour candidate in West Ham, they basically, they were like, they wanted to have what Hardy had and McDonald had. You know, so I actually give credit to the party because they saw what was coming, you know. And they were trying to warn, funny enough, they're trying to warn people, and obviously people didn't listen. Cheers.
Okay, Andy, you've been waiting patiently.
Yeah, so can you hear me okay, guys?
Yeah, but we can't see you, we can hear you.
Okay. All I was wanting to really say was, first of all, I was sort of a bit dumbfounded as to know what to say because it was such an excellent presentation. So thanks, Adam and Darren. The other thing that just sort of struck me, and I don't want to say a lot really, but was that I joined the party, I think they finally let me in the year 2000. And around that time, or quite shortly after that, David Perrin, David A. Perrin, who I hope is still a party member and an active person behind the scenes, wrote a brilliant book. I'll just put it up here. Right. Those of us that have been to head office will probably recognise it. The Socialist Party of Great Britain, Politics, Economics and Britain's Oldest Socialist Party, which actually I'm in the process of dipping into again now, and it's brilliant. It mentions all, you know, a lot of those people that Darren and Adam have mentioned, and some of those dispute situations, the historical context of it all. It's really fascinating. So that's all I really wanted to say on that. So thanks.
Incidentally, the first part of Bartrop's The Monument answers the point that Paddy made, but it also deals with the social context as to how these suburbs like East Ham and West Ham were, you know, the workers had moved out of central London, you know, to live there, and there were disputes over workmen, you know, workmen's trains, and I think some party members were actually active in getting better workmen's trains, but that was you know, that part of Bartrop's book is quite good, actually. You know, it's not dealing with the disputes that we've been talking about, but you know, the social context of where workers lived and how they work and how they got to work and so on. Anyway, Brian.
Sorry there. Thank you, Adam. I just had to add against the queries that Paddy and Darren put forward in regards to what were the conversations within the early party. Well, if you have a look at the contents of this standard that's been put up and look at the correspondence, you'll find out exactly what the party was up against. So it's the same old arguments that we got ourselves now, and that is reform and revolution. So we're still arguing the toss over that, and this is what they were arguing over in 1905. What I find interesting about that article in the correspondence is the end, which I find rather flippant remark by the author in reply to the original article. And I find it rather arrogant, you know, that he's kind of, to me, throws in the towel and says, well, there you are, get on with it, you know. That's how I see the response by this guy, whoever he is. Right, that's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Were you talking about the the correspondence in the June 1905 Socialist Standard, were you?
Yes,
this H. Philpott Wright.
Yes, that's the one.
I don't know whether he was ever a party member at one time, but he kept on. He keeps on, you know, writing back these long screeds. Yeah. Okay. Howard.
Just to endorse what Andy said about Dave Perrin's book, published in 2000, The Socialist Party of Great Britain: Politics, Economics, and Britain's Oldest Socialist Party. It's a brilliant book. I go to it time and again for all sorts of things. And Andy wonders whether Dave is still an active member. Well, of course he is. He's a key member of the Socialist Standard Production Committee. And he's actually got an article in this month, a review in this month's Socialist Standard. Still very much. I mean, he doesn't come to any of these sessions, I know, but obviously people have their own lives to lead. But signs his articles DAP, in case people don't know who DAP is. It's Dave Perrin. Just a matter of information there.
Yes, he is a member of the editorial committee. Dougie.
Yeah, it's fascinating to talk about this, really. But I think, you know, just before the First World War, I think there was a few ILP people got elected to Parliament. I think it was mainly for Glasgow or whatever, you know. And, they were talking about the abolition of the wages system in Parliament sometimes. But when the war started, they went off to fight, you know, and strange thing, right? You know, they were internationalist in one sense, and then when Britain was at war with Germany, they thought they had to go and fight, right? You know, so I don't know, but I mean, I don't know if you know anything about that. I read it quite a while ago. Yeah. Okay, that was all I wanted to say. Thanks.
You've got your hand up, Darren.
Yeah, just a quick reply to Dougie's point. I think you might have misremembered that, Dougie. The Labour only had one MP in Glasgow before the First World War. It was a guy called George Barnes, in the centre of Glasgow Blackfriars Division, which is kind of the Garbles. He was also the leader of the Labour Party briefly in 1910, 1911. He ended up joining the administration. I think you're thinking of the ILPers who were elected en masse after the war. People like Jimmy Maxton, Davy Kirkwood, George Buchanan, Neil Maclean. And in fairness to them, especially Maxton, he was a conscientious objector during First World War and did actually go to jail as a consequence. And he actually debated with the party in Maxton in 1928. Jack Fitzgerald was the party speaker. It's written up in the Standard from that period. It's quite an interesting. He almost comes across as a Corbyn-like character, to be honest. You know, I quite like Maxton. Cheers. Thanks.
Yeah, I think if we're talking about what happened afterwards, I think probably the worst thing that happened was the Communist Party, you know, coming into existence. That would have diverted lots of people down a completely dead end, but we managed to survive during the interwar period, you know, still arguing, you know, Marxist case, if you like, rather than the Leninist. But I think that if it hadn't been the Russian Revolution or hadn't been the Communist Party, things might have been slightly different anyway. But
I was talking about somebody got elected for the ILP just before the First World War, and I can't remember where it was. It was maybe Doncaster or somewhere in England or whatever. And he was talking about revolution, but he went off to fight in the First World War. I can't remember his name, but he was an ILPer.
And you may be thinking of Victor Grayson, who was. He won. He was an independent Labour candidate
No, it wasn't Victor Grayson. It was somebody else. I can't remember his name. I read about it, you know, and I mentioned it in a talk I did, but I don't know. And there was a few ILPs went over to the Labour Party after the First World War. Yeah.
Well, no, well, the ILP was part of the Labour Party. The only people who were elected as ILPs outside the Labour Party was maybe Keir Hardie in the 1890s. And then when the ILP disaffiliated from the Labour Party in 1932, four or five of them were elected in Glasgow. People like Jimmy Maxton, John McGovern and Shettleson. That's the only ILPers who've ever been elected as ILPers. There were lots of ILPers elected as Labour MPs, but not necessarily as ILPs.
And of course, Ramsay MacDonald himself was a member of the ILP, because you before 1918 you couldn't join the Labour Party as an individual. If you wanted to join a party, you had to join the ILP or the Fabian Society. But there was a militant miners' leader called Stanton. Keir Hardie died in 1915, and there was a by-election in Merthyr, and this form of firebrand miners agitator got elected. But he became completely pro-war, and but I don't know whether he was a member of the ILP or not, possibly. But, of course, the Labour Party, when it was first formed, was really the Labour Parliamentary Party. It was these 20 or 30 MPs that had been elected with Liberal support, who formed themselves into a group within the House of Commons with a whip and so on, and a leader, and they became the Labour Party. So I mean, our claim that we were formed before the Labour Party is based on that, but before then there was this organisation called the Labour Representation Committee, but they didn't get any representation until 1906. In fact, they didn't. Labour Party never regarded itself as a socialist party. They saw themselves as a trade union pressure group to try and get laws passed in the interest of trade unions or the repeal of laws which were against the interests of trade unions. And basically, they were liberals or liblabs. Darren has mentioned this pact between Herbert Gladstone, who was Gladstone's son, for the Liberals, and Ramsay MacDonald for the for the ILP. And you can see it. There's an article in the Standard after that election which analysed exactly what happened. There were lots of two-member constituencies, so that there'd be one Liberal and one Labour candidate standing in there. And so the original Labour Party was basically the left wing of the Liberal Party. And Dan also mentioned a lot of Liberal MPs and intellectuals who went over to the Labour Party, to the Labour Party. I mean, one of them, of course, was Wedgwood Benn's father, who'd been a Liberal, and he became a cabinet minister in one of the interwar Labour, Labour governments. But to come back to a question that Paddy originally asked, well, what sort of things did party members have to deal with? I don't think it was necessarily, high politics. I think, Robert Tressel's The Ragged Child of Philanthropists will give a good idea of the sort of arguments that party members would have had to put up to a bit or deal with when they're arguing with fellow members of the working class. There was something that I forgot to mention in my introductory talk about whether or not Britain was a democracy at that time. And it wasn't, because all women and no women and one third of men didn't have a vote for Parliament, but women did have a vote for local councils. And in fact, Engels once voted for a woman candidate for the Hoosier Liberal, incidentally, in 1876 for the London School Board. So some women, obviously property-owning women, did have the vote during this period, but not for Parliament. Do you want to add anything, Darren, before we...
I think I'm all talked out.
And the other thing I noted down here is that Battersea Town Hall, where the party used to hold debates and meetings, still exists. It's now an arts centre. So if you want to visit it, you can see it. It's on the way to head office. Most of Battersea was bombed during the war. Most of old Battersea was bombed during the war. And I think there's this book by the Trotskyist, was it Harry Wicks, Keeping My Head, also describes the activity of the party in Battersea, which had a lot of small factories and so on. So the party was quite well known there. And I think as well that they even continued during this period Socialist Sunday School, which was founded by a member of the SDF. So that it hadn't completely sort of escaped from its SDFism at that time. Okay, Andy, want to say something again?
Yeah, it was just interesting that you mentioned that about Battersea. And, hopefully it will be taken as a light-hearted point. But Morrissey, the singer, who is a bit like Marmite or Mustard. He wrote a song called You're the One for Me, Fatty, and it mentions Battersea a lot in the lyrics. I thought that might be something that Mike Foster would be aware of. So it's just thought I'd mention that as a light-hearted, late-night aside. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. Of course, Battersea today isn't the same as Battersea, at the time, or Battersea between the wars. Battersea got bombed because of all the small factories that were there during the last, the last World War. So the streets that I mentioned, were outdoor speaking things and wasn't... You can't find them anymore. They're not there.
Well, anyway, Mike's into it. He's put a message up in the chat.
So. Okay.
I think Morrissey... Sorry, I've not put my hand up, but I think maybe Morrissey was talking about the dog's home.
If we've finished the serious stuff, it was just that... it's just this one song he's got. It's sort of a bit of a silly song, really, called You're the One for Me, Fatty. And they go all over Battersea, I want, what is it, or something like that. And there's this girl in the song that he adores, and she lives in Battersea, and it does refer to Battersea being flattened and things like that. But also Morrissey had done a song about, I think it's Every Day Is Like Sunday, about, bring on like the nuclear war and all this sort of thing, because he was so miserable,
Sounds as if he chose Battersea because it rhymes with something else ending in C. Anyway. Darren knows about music as well, so more than me. Right, are we more or less finished, are we?